if he'd been exposed when the theocracy had rounded up insurgents in Gibraltar, they might well have let him go deliberately, either in the hopes he'd lead them to the rebel base or because his mere presence might spread doubt and confusion. Davidson wasn't sure he wanted the young man to speak.
"Luis," Jess said, "tell us what happened."
"They rounded us up," Luis said.
There was a gasp from one of the men behind him.
"My cell. They took us all. They just left us in the camp for 5 days, then dragged me out and showed me that they had my family captive.
And then they told me that I could take a message to you or watch my family die one by one."
He broke down into sobs.
"Sophia is only 9, he said. "How could I let them? They were going to..."
Davidson could guess. They'd threatened to rape his sister, forcing him to make a very hard choice. "They sent you with a message, I presume?" Jess said. Her voice was very cold. "What did they want you to say?"
"They're organizing the city to suit themselves," Louise said between sobs. "If we don't submit to them, they will crush us. If we join them, we will have rewards."
"That's assuming we trust them," one of the other men said. He spat. "Why should we trust a word this traitor has to say? Cut his throat and have done with it."
"Interrogate him," Davidson urged. It had been 7 days since the occupation had begun. Luis hadn't spent all of that time in a detention camp. But there was the very real possibility that the theocracy had stuck a tracker on him. A nanotech implant would be undetectable, at least with the tech they had on hand, until it started to transmit.
"But we can't afford to take him elsewhere."
Jess glared at Luis.
"You ask him the questions," she snarled.
"I need to make preparations to break camp."
Davidson sat down in front of Louise, then sighed inwardly. There wouldn't be any need for drugs or torture to make Louise talk, he was sure. The young man wasn't trying to hide anything from them. It was merely a matter of asking the right questions.
"Tell me what happened when they invested the city," he said. "What happened to you?"
The story that emerged was horrific, although unsurprising. Most of the insurgents had burned themselves up attacking Government House, believing that the day of liberation was finally at hand. The survivors had fallen back when the theocracy's forces had reached the city and surrounded it, then advanced towards the center in multiple armored prongs. They'd kept warning people to stay in their homes, and most of the population, seeing bullets flying, had done as they were told. But this had allowed the theocracy a chance to snatch all the city's vital installations before the insurgents could react. It had only gotten worse from then onwards, Luis admitted. The theocracy had been everywhere, taking over schools as barracks and knocking down places of worship with a fervor born of fanaticism. The destruction of one church, the oldest on the planet, had brought worshippers out in protest, and they'd been met with armed troops who'd opened fire. And then the survivors had been put to work clearing rubble from the streets.
"By the time I was caught, restrictions were tightening on everyone," he said. "My sisters were told never to go outside without a male escort. Kids were told they wouldn't be going back to school until the educational system was revised. Anyone who tried to hide a priest or a government official was shot. I don't know what happened to the priests."
"I can guess," Davidson said.
He sighed. Terror, it seemed, would be the driving force behind the occupation. The locals would be terrorized until they submitted, having been taught the futility of resistance. Some would always break and accept the new order, changing their religion to blend in with their new masters. And then they would serve as puppets for the theocracy.
"The social controls weaken the society they overwhelm," he thought.
It would be easy to restrict women from all public roles if going outside alone brought threats of rape or death. How long would it be, he asked himself, before such separation of the sexes seemed natural and right? And it also serves as incentive for women to convert, perhaps leading their husbands with them.
"I wonder," he said, "is the PDC still intact?"
"I don't know," Louise said. "I heard nothing.
Davidson scowled. The PDC was immune to orbital bombardment, at least from weapons that wouldn't render the planet uninhabitable. But the base could be surrounded, isolated, and then stormed by forces on the ground. And with jamming still pervading the airwaves, there was no way to know what had happened to General Eastside. All Davidson could do was assume the worst. Jess walked back to face him.
"I think we can't stay here any longer," she said. She produced a knife from her belt and held it out towards Luis.
"And don't," Davidson said. "He didn't ask to come here." Luis tensed. An unpleasant smell filled the air as he voided his bowels.
"He chose to carry their message," Jess snapped. "That makes him a traitor."
"But not a willing one," Davidson said. If the insurgency became increasingly desperate and ruthless, the locals caught in the middle would turn to the theocracy out of sheer self-preservation.
"Leave him here. He can make his own way home if he wants."
"He'll kill me," Luis said.
It's your only hope," Jess said.
She pushed him to the ground, then used her knife to saw through his bonds.
"Count to 1,000 before you look up, then go wherever you want."
She turned and caught Davidson's hand, then led him back into the darkening forest. Davidson had to admit to the sharpness of her skills as she walked through the woods. Even with his implants, it was growing increasingly difficult to see in the dark. He glanced up and saw flickers of fire high overhead as pieces of debris continued to fall out of orbit and burn up in the planet's atmosphere. The theocracy, it seemed, hadn't bothered to sweep the orbitals after winning the battle.
"We had someone in a village that got visited by the new occupation," Jess said very softly. "He said they'd been told that any resistance would result in the destruction of their village, and that any sightings of resistance fighters had to be reported at once, and if they weren't, the village would be destroyed after the hostages had been brutally murdered right in front of them."
Davidson winced. It wasn't fair to expect parents to keep their mouths shut when their children were at risk, and no one would take the chance that theocracy was bluffing when it threatened to hurt the children. The villagers would be caught between two fires. They could serve the insurgency and risk losing everything when the theocracy caught them, or serve the theocracy and risk losing everything when they were punished for collaboration. Jess caught his arm, then spun him round to face her. In the darkness, her face seemed surprisingly pale.
"Tell me," she said.
Her voice was very low, as if she was afraid of being overheard.
"Do we have a chance?"
"Not on your own," Davidson admitted. There was no avoiding that conclusion. "The Commonwealth never wanted to rip your society apart, let alone take hostages and hold others accountable for what their brothers did. But the theocracy has the tools to do just that, Jess. Given time, they will have your entire planet locked down tighter than Earth." He shuddered. It was hard to know how many of the horror stories about UN-ruled Earth were actually true, but it was well known that no one had had any privacy, and freedom of speech was largely a joke. No one could do anything on Earth without leaving a trace behind, one that could be followed by the police and used as evidence against them. The entire planetary society had been falling apart even before the breakaway wars.
"Shit," Jess said.
She let go of his arm, then started to pace frantically.
"Should we just surrender then? Walk up to them and offer the bastards our throats, so they can cut them as efficiently as possible?"
"Hell no," Davidson said. "The Commonwealth is still out there, Jess. They will organize a rescue mission given time, or simply win the war outright. And when the system is attacked for the second time, you and your people can strike against the bastards on the ground. You can bide your time until then."
"And how many horrors," Jess asked, "will go unchallenged until then?"
"Far too many," Davidson said. He paused, weighing his words carefully. He could understand how despair might be working its way through the insurgency, now that they saw their new enemy far too clearly. Somehow, he had to try to encourage her.
"And we will be staying to help."
Jess snorted.
How much can a handful of Marines like you do for us?
Train you, Davidson said. It was true. Marines had a great deal of training in insurgent warfare, although they'd generally been trying to defeat insurgencies rather than actually encourage them. And coordinate with the relief force when it finally arrives. He took a breath.
But we need to know if the PDC is still active, he added.
A thought had occurred to him. There had been heavy armaments stockpiled in the PDC, as well as shield generators and planetary defense weapons.
If so, we might have other options.
Oh, Jess said.
To die, bravely?
Maybe, Davidson said. He gave her a sharp look. Part of him wanted to ask her story. Why she'd become an insurgent. He wasn't sure he wanted to know, though. She was a girl doing a job most of the planet would have said was a man's job. But she'd survived when others more trusting had gone like lambs to the slaughter.
We will see.
Jess eyed him for a long moment, then turned and led the way into the darkening forest. Chapter 37
The PDC is still holding out, the cleric observed. Why is it still holding out?
Because the Janissaries have failed to capture it? Admiral Junaid asked smoothly. Or because the Inquisition has made it clear that prisoners of war cannot expect good treatment? It was all he could do to smile rather than scream in rage. The battle had gone well, but the war was not yet won. There was absolutely nothing to be gained from mistreating prisoners, even if they were infidels who would never be allowed to return home, let alone imposing theocratic rule on the locals. There would be time to convert the infidels after the war was over. But the Inquisitors had refused to delay their work. They needed a success to bolster their positions when the Speaker died and the next power struggle began.
You should flatten a base from orbit, the cleric said. Stamp on it with a hammer.
Anything we use powerful enough to crack the base's force field will devastate the local environment, Junaid pointed out, for what felt like the thousandth time. An antimatter bomb would depopulate all of Cadiz. I hardly think the Speaker will thank you for exterminating an entire planet of potential converts. He took a breath.
And the Commonwealth would certainly retaliate in kind, he added sharply. We would see the entire theocracy turned into nothing more than dead worlds.
The cleric snorted but said nothing. Junaid turned his attention back to the latest update, cursing Princess Drusilla under his breath. Her father should have beaten her into submission or had her brain rewired from the moment it had become clear she was far from the ideal wife for a theocratic officer. But he'd been merciful, and this was the result. The Commonwealth had detected his fleet, the attack had been launched ahead of schedule, and a carefully prepared plan lay in tatters. Half of the attack fleets that should have swept into Commonwealth space were still on their way, while there was no way to know, yet, just what had happened to the fleets that had already reached their targets. And his goddamned fleet train was overdue. Junaid cursed the planners under his breath. Surely they could have assigned more freighters to his fleet before he assembled it, but no, they'd insisted the fleet train would be assembled later and forwarded to him. As he should have expected, he was 50 light-years from his base, waiting for the freighters to catch up with him. There was no way he could go on the offensive again until he had reloaded his ships.
At least we captured a few thousand workers, he thought.
The Inquisitors had wanted to round up the space workers along with everyone else, but he'd managed to snatch the infidel engineers for himself and put them to work.
But converting their weapons to launch from our ships is impossible.
The infidels are still out there, Junaid observed. They're watching and waiting. He scowled. At least 5 starships were watching the system, sneaking in until they were detected and then escaping at high speed rather than sticking round to fight. It was hard to blame them. They were only destroyers, after all. But it was a constant headache. As it was, he didn't dare draw down the forces defending Cadiz or Cadiz 7. It left the other inhabited worlds in the system largely uncovered. The cleric
turned to face him.
Admiral, he said, are you having doubts about the ultimate success of our operation?
And if you knew more, Junaid thought, you'd be having doubts too.
God never promised us an easy victory, he said instead. But we cannot go back on the offensive until our fleet train arrives.
He triggered the display, then studied the star chart thoughtfully. Where would the infidel fleet go?
It was tempting to believe they'd flee all the way to Tyre, but he knew better than to believe it, no matter what he told the cleric and the inquisitors. The infidels had been caught by surprise, crippled by their own leaders, yet they'd managed to escape under heavy fire. They were no cowards, he told himself firmly, nor were they incompetent. And if they weren't caught by surprise, they would be a dangerous foe.
10 days, he asked himself. Where could they have gone in 10 days?
Then we will wait until it arrives, the cleric said. By then we will know about the other assaults, will we not?
Perhaps, Junaid said. He hoped the attacking fleets could capture Starcom units, but he knew better than to count on it. The infidels would definitely destroy them if they had the chance, just to make it harder for the theocracy to coordinate its offensive. But we will still know nothing about how the infidels are reacting.
That extra squadron of super dreadnoughts is doing nothing, Lieutenant Lindsay Harrison reported. They're just sitting in orbit.
Commander Pete Hellman frowned. HMS Primrose had been playing catch-as-catch-can with the Theocracy's patrols ever since she had returned to Cadiz with the remainder of her squadron. To be fair, apart from the odd patrol through the asteroids, the Theocracy seemed to be focusing their attention on Cadiz itself and Cadiz 7. But it made no sense. The asteroid miners had had plenty of time to rig their facilities to blow, then hide in uncharted asteroid habits. Logically, the Theocracy should have swept them up in the first few hours of the occupation.
It could be a set of drones and nothing else, he suggested. Do you think they're solid contacts?
They definitely came out of a vortex, Lindsay objected. She'd been a sensor officer long enough to gain plenty of experience. I don't think they could fake that, sir.
Pete nodded reluctantly.
4 squadrons of super dreadnoughts, several battered, 52 smaller ships. The Theocracy had assigned a surprising amount of firepower to the system. It had made sense when they'd intended to trap and destroy Seventh Fleet, but not now. There was little in the system worth taking, let alone tying up so much firepower in holding. He wasn't sure if it was a reflection of the enemy's power. They could afford to spare 4 squadrons of super dreadnoughts for Cadiz, or something else was at play. Were they waiting to hear from other attack forces that had entered Commonwealth space?
Keep a sharp eye on the bastards, he ordered.
He turned to face the helmsman.
Alter our course randomly, then take us away from the planet.
Aye, sir, Lieutenant Sean Dorsey said. I don't think there's anything in our way. Pete snorted. They were cloaked. And any hunting Theocracy starships would also be cloaked. It was unlikely they'd accidentally collide with an enemy ship, but they might well completely miss one another with their respective invisibility. He settled back in his command chair as Primrose put some distance between herself and Cadiz, then tried not to think about what the enemy might be doing. It was quite possible they'd already started hitting worlds far closer to Tyre than Cadiz.
They wouldn't have risked such a disaster, he told himself.
An operation of that magnitude would be such a violent breach of the KISS principle that it would almost certainly be guaranteed disaster for anyone stupid enough to try.
If their attacks failed, they'd cripple themselves in an afternoon.
Captain, Midshipwoman Han said, we're nearing the remote platform.
Query it, Pete ordered. Tactical, stand by all weapons.
Aye, sir. Lieutenant Commander David White said. Weapons ready. Pete braced himself. The platforms were, in theory, undetectable, unless someone literally stumbled over one of them. The spy probes were also meant to be undetectable, though, and the Theocracy had managed to detect one of them. If someone had managed to detect the platform, they might have staked it out rather than simply destroying it.
watching and waiting for a Commonwealth starship to come along. And if the ship was engaged completely without warning, there would be no time to escape before it was blown into debris.
Captain, Hans said, the platform is requesting a full data dump. Every last scrap of tactical data we have.
Send it, Pete ordered.
Was someone planning to attack the system? It didn't seem likely. The Seventh Fleet was far too degraded to take the offensive. And yet there was no need for the data unless someone was planning to attack the system.
And then hold us steady.
Aye, Captain, Davidson said.
There was a long pause.
The data dump has been sent, Han then reported. There's no saved response.
Pete nodded.
Take us away from the platform, he ordered.
By now the signal will be racing across the system where someone was waiting for it.
And then sneak back towards the planet.
Davidson looked up.
Sir?
Someone needs tactical data, Pete said. Let us see what we can provide.
Admiral Christian was so much more efficient than Admiral Morrison that it wasn't even remotely funny, Kat decided as she sipped her tea. Apart from their first private meeting, he'd insisted that all meetings be held electronically, allowing all of his senior officers to attend. Admiral Morrison, she knew, would have insisted on his officers meeting him on the planet. Ironically, that might just have worked in Seventh Fleet's favor.
The data collected by the destroyers suggests the enemy are guarding Cadiz extensively, an analyst said. One squadron of super dreadnoughts has apparently reinforced the fleet. We must assume those ships have full magazines, but there does not appear to be a fleet train in the system. We dare not take that for granted, of course.
Kat nodded in agreement. Cadiz was largely valueless now the war had begun, save for the facilities orbiting Cadiz 7. If those super dreadnoughts had been able to take the offensive, she was sure they would have attacked Gamma Base by now. The base was only meant as a stopgap, but it was the most likely target. Instead, the super dreadnoughts had sat on their butts and done nothing.
A smaller formation composed largely of battle cruisers is covering Cadiz 7, the analyst continued. We must assume that the industrial platforms have been occupied and their crews have been captured. The enemy has clearly decided they are vitally important.
She took a breath.
I believe the plan remains sound, she concluded. They are more likely to defend Cadiz 7 than Cadiz itself.
Good, Admiral Christian said. Are there any questions?
Kat keyed a switch. What about ground forces?
As far as we can tell, the PDC is still in our hands, the analyst said. Her force field is definitely still active, and a theocratic warship seemed to be avoiding entering weapons range. However, it has proven impossible to activate a communications link, so we have no way of knowing the situation on the ground. Nor do we have any links with anyone else on the surface.
Patrick, Kat thought, feeling a twinge of guilt. He wasn't dead. He couldn't be dead. And yet part of her was convinced she'd sent him to his death. I'm sorry. Admiral Christian waited to see if anyone else had a question, then pressed forward.
There is no need to alter our basic operational plan, he said. Force 1 will jump into the system in 30 minutes once we are in position near Cadiz 7. Force 2 will wait until hearing from Force 1, he glanced at Kat's image sharply. Then jump out near Cadiz, sweep orbital space of any unexpected surprises, and then send down shuttles to rescue our personnel.
He took a breath.
It is possible the theocracy won't take the bait, he added. In that case, Force 1 will destroy the facilities orbiting Cadiz 7 and then withdraw.
Kat couldn't imagine the theocrats not taking the bait. The extra squadron of super dreadnoughts had been a nasty surprise. Combined with what they already knew about enemy super dreadnoughts, the theocrats would have a pronounced firepower advantage. And Admiral Christian would be tempting them with the prospect of catching Sixth Fleet in a gravitational well. A fleet couldn't open enough vortexes to escape so close to a gas giant. Even one ship would be pushing her luck if she tried to escape. And yet they might well have shot their bolt, she thought. If only we knew for certain. She shook her head. The cadets had been told often enough that there were no certainties in a war. War was a democracy. The enemy got a vote, too. Whatever choices the enemy's CO made could be relied upon to screw up or limit the choices available to his opponents.
We could always go after their super dreadnoughts,
a captain she didn't recognize said. Her data console identified him as Captain Yu.
They would be a tempting target.
We may do so, Admiral Christian said. But our first priority is destroying the facilities and trying to recover our people.
He looked down at his wristcom, making a show of it.
Are there any final issues to discuss?
There were none. Kat was silently relieved. A handful of officers from 6th Fleet had complained about her being given command of Force 2, even though it was composed of starships from 7th Fleet. The Admiral had pointed out that Kat was the only commanding officer they knew, and there was no time to get the ships and crews used to a newcomer, while 6th Fleet had drilled as a unit. They would be a match, she had told herself after watching one of their exercises, for a superior number of theocratic super-dreadnoughts. And they had the training and discipline to stand off gunboats.
Very well, Admiral Christian said. Force 1 will begin the offensive in 30 minutes.
He paused, then looked from image to image.
The war began in the most treacherous manner possible, he said. They struck directly at Tyre itself and countless other worlds, leaving thousands of dead civilians in their wake. This isn't a localized border dispute, nor is it a rebellion against tyrannical central authority. This is all-out war aimed at shaping the future of the entire galaxy. If we lose, the worlds we have sworn to defend will fall under the rule of a religious society intent on crushing all its rivals. We dare not lose. We will not lose. We will fight, he continued. We will fight them at Cadiz. We will fight them at Gamma Base. We will fight them at Cottbus, Hebrides, and Iceland. We will fight until they are pushed out of our space, then carry the offensive into their territory. We will keep fighting until we are standing in the ruins of Ahura Mazda, dictating peace terms to the so-called believers. For who can dare claim to believe in God when they slaughter civilians merely to gain a slight advantage?
He took a long breath.
We will win this war, he concluded. And when we are done, the galaxy will be a better place. Dismissed.
Kat cut the channel and watched as the images of her fellow commanding officers popped like soap bubbles. 30 minutes. 30 minutes before they would know if Force 2 would have its chance to redeem itself, or if they would just fall back into hyperspace and wait for the Admiral. She sat for a long moment, then rose to her feet and headed for the bridge. Whatever happened, she told herself as she walked through the hatch, she would meet it squarely.
Captain on the bridge,
the XO said.
I have the bridge,
Kat said. She sat in her chair and surveyed the display.
Do we have direct data links established with Force 2?
Aye, Captain,
the XO said. He sounded confident. They'd improved the command and control system considerably during their flight from Cadiz.
They're reporting that they're ready to move.
Kat nodded, although she had her doubts. They'd only had 2 days outside hyperspace to exercise the 9 warships and 5 troop transports the Admiral had placed under her command. If she'd had more time... She smiled tightly. If there had been more time, the Admiral might have put someone else in command, reasoning that the new commander would have enough time to meet his subordinates and learn how they thought. She knew she wouldn't be allowed to retain command once the front lines settled. But for the moment, she would enjoy it. And give the theocracy one hell of a bloody nose, she thought.
Then take us to the first waypoint, she ordered.
On the display, Force 1 was already heading towards its target. It looked invincible. And yet she knew the theocracy had more raw firepower.
Try to keep us away from any potential guard ships.
She thought briefly of the message her father had sent to her. It had been short and sweet, sweeter than she'd expected. He'd told her about his new job, at least in vague terms, yet thankfully he hadn't tried to pressure her to return to Tyre.
Even in wartime, her father could presumably have influenced her commanding officers to order her home. Kat was relieved more than she cared to admit.
I will see this out to the end, she thought coldly. And I will not leave anyone behind this time.
We're approaching the first waypoint,
Weiberg reported.
No sign of any guard ships,
Roach reported. He sounded perplexed. They'd trained to avoid any starships near the planet.
Local hyperspace near Cadiz appears clear.
Kat and the XO exchanged a look. Standard procedure was to keep a guardship in hyperspace near a planet, particularly in a war zone. Who knew when the enemy might be sneaking up on an unsuspecting target? But the theocracy might have concluded there would be no immediate counterattack. Or they might have something else up their sleeve.
Hold us here, she ordered. There was no time for worrying, not now. We'll wait for the Admiral's signal.
And then go on the offensive, her own thoughts added. Let the dice fly high. Chapter 38
Admiral, I'm picking up vortexes. Multiple vortexes. The sensor officer snapped as alarms howled through the Sword of God. They're opening near Cadiz 7.
Show me,
Admiral Junaid ordered. And then bring the fleet to battle stations.
He looked up at the display, thinking hard. Commonwealth's 7th Fleet was in no state for a counterattack. Unless, of course, the current fleet commander preferred to die heroically rather than report home and face the Commonwealth's judgment for losing a battle. And there were more super dreadnought-sized vortexes than there should have been, if it were 7th Fleet alone. It suggested the Commonwealth had moved reinforcements into the sector quicker than he would have believed possible. The display cleared as the vortexes closed. There was no way to track the intruding starships in real time, not now. They'd have to take the fleet a great deal closer to have a hope of tracking, then engaging the enemy. He thought fast. Cadiz was important, but right now, the facilities orbiting Cadiz 7 were far more important. Losing them and their crews to enemy fire would make his deployment supply problems, already bad, far worse. The facilities had to be defended. And yet, the enemy would know he had to cover Cadiz 7. They could be setting a trap.
Set course for Cadiz 7, Junaid ordered. The forces on the ground could take care of themselves now that his fleet had deployed the orbital bombardment platforms, which would hammer any traces of opposition from high overhead.
Open vortexes on my mark, then plot exit coordinates here.
He tapped a point on the display. Well outside Cadiz 7's gravity well. If this was a trap, if the enemy outgunned him significantly, he could retreat back into hyperspace rather than fight a losing battle. Theocratic intelligence had already failed once. If there were more than 3 squadrons of super dreadnoughts waiting for him, he wasn't too proud to retreat.
That's quite some distance from the planet, the cleric observed. Are you sure you don't want to come out closer to the facilities?
We need room to maneuver, Junaid pointed out. The hell of it was that the infidels could devastate the platforms before his fleet arrived if they hurled themselves straight into the gravity well. There was simply no way to rewrite the laws of interstellar travel to get the fleet there any faster.
And we can try to trap them against the planet.
Assuming they don't outgun us, he added in the privacy of his head.
Vortex generators online, the helmsman said. Take us out, Junaid ordered.
Moments later, they slipped through the vortex and headed into hyperspace.
Captain, Roach said, I am picking up enemy ships entering hyperspace.
Kat nodded. Hyperspace rolled and boiled as super dreadnought after super dreadnought plunged through the vortexes and slid into hyperspace, then set course for Cadiz 7. She had to admire their determination, although she knew it was driven by fear of losing what they'd captured. Normally, navigating through hyperspace within a star system was a tricky proposition, even though it was safer than trying to fly through an energy storm. But they didn't really have a choice if they wanted to protect their facilities. She looked at her console, frowning.
Have they seen us?
I don't think so, Captain,
Roach said.
But it's impossible to be sure.
They would have closed to engage, surely, the XO pointed out. or simply launched a few missiles in our direction and fled.
Cat nodded. Hyperspace was always oddly twisted near a gravity well. Few officers would have dared to lurk so close to a planet's hyperspace shadow, knowing their sensors and communications would be utterly unreliable. If the fleet they were seeing hadn't matched the known configuration of the theocratic fleet they'd observed earlier, she would have feared that it was another series of sensor ghosts.
"Give them 5 minutes," she ordered, "and then prepare to take us out of hyperspace."
"Aye, aye, Captain,"
Wyberg said.
"I did a head count," the Exo said. "They left behind 5 destroyers, at least."
"Then we'll deal with them," Kat said firmly. She sucked in her breath as the minutes ticked away. The destroyers alone posed no real problem, but the real danger was enemy gunboats, or one of their ships jumping out in time to alert the main fleet that Cadiz was under attack. She had no illusions about the balance of firepower. If the enemy fleet doubled back, she would have no option but immediate retreat, leaving the people on the ground to an uncertain, probably unpleasant, fate.
"Prepare to raise shields as soon as we exit hyperspace," she ordered, as the seconds ticked down to 0.
"Take us out? Now!"
Her stomach clenched as the vortex flowered to life in front of her. Then lightning surged forward and burst out into real space. The display flickered, then updated. A handful of red icons circled the planet in high orbit. Destroyers, she noted, and a handful of captured freighters, all Commonwealth designs. It looked as though there were no theocratic freighters at all.
"They must have wanted to capture freighters, too," she thought with grim amusement. "They can't fight a war without bullets and beans."
"Target the enemy ships," she ordered, as the makeshift squadron spread out round lightning.
"Fire at will."
The destroyers had their shields up, she noted, but they clearly hadn't seriously expected an attack. Cadiz was largely worthless, after all, compared to the facilities. Kat watched with grim satisfaction as her starships belched missiles, launching far more than strictly necessary to smash the enemy ships. The destroyers, their vortex generators powered down, didn't have a hope of escaping. One by one, they were overwhelmed and destroyed. The freighters died moments later.
"All targets destroyed," Roach reported.
He paused.
"Automated weapons platforms are swinging to target us."
"Take them out," Kat ordered.
They didn't seem designed to engage starships, judging from the surveillance records, but that didn't stop them from being dangerous. And, more practically, they might well have orders to bombard the planet indiscriminately if they believed they were about to lose control.
"Then attempt to raise the PDC." "Aye, Captain," Roach said.
"Standard communication links are down," Ross added. "I'm attempting to make contact through laser now." Kat wasn't surprised. The theocracy had blanketed the planet in jamming, according to the surveillance reports. It would be a nuisance to their operations, but absolutely nightmarish to any surviving Commonwealth forces. She had the strong feeling that anyone who'd remained alive would have gone into hiding, convinced they were the only surviving Commonwealth personnel on Cadiz. Or they might have been wiped out by the insurgents, or the theocracy.
"See if you can locate the sources of the jamming," the XO suggested. "We would make much faster progress if we could use radios."
"Aye, sir," Ross said.
"Captain," Roach snapped as the display washed red. "We were just swept by an active tactical sensor."
Kat blinked in surprise. There were no other enemy starships in orbit, and the orbital platforms were being smashed one by one. They didn't even have a chance to shoot back. Not with weapons intended to bombard a planet rather than engage starships. But why bother with an active sensor sweep, running the risk of revealing one's position if there was no way the information could be used? She didn't like the potential implications.
"Find the source," she snapped. "And then bring up long-range sensors and sweep the entire orbital sphere." "Aye, Captain," Roach said. He started to work his console, then swore. "Captain, I'm picking up missile emissions in orbit."
Kat stared as new icons appeared on the display. The theocracy hadn't managed to get a supply convoy into the system since they'd booted the Commonwealth out of it, unless the observing destroyers had missed something. But if they were critically low on missile stocks, she knew how many they'd fired during First Cadiz. They wouldn't have unloaded so many into orbit just to help defend the planet.
it would have rendered their super dreadnoughts largely defenseless. And then, as the display identified the missiles, she knew the truth. "They took our missile stockpiles," she said, mentally cursing Admiral Morrison. The stockpiles that should have been used to prepare 7th Fleet for battle had been captured by the theocrats. They hadn't been able to transfer them into their starships, but that hadn't stopped their commander from finding a use for them. "Order the transports to fall back, then brace for missile attack."
"Suggest we use our IFFs, too," the XO added as the missiles came to life. "We might manage to disarm them."
Kat nodded. "See to it," she added, "and use our own ship killers to thin the herd." She braced herself as a tidal wave of missiles roared towards her tiny squadron. If they'd had time to jump out. She checked the display and realized they had another 5 minutes to wait before they could make their escape, no matter the danger. Her ship killers detonated ahead of lightning, blowing holes in the enemy missile formation, but there were hundreds of missiles inbound. She gritted her teeth, knowing she might be about to lose her ship, her life, and the entire squadron. They should have anticipated such a trick from an enemy commander who had proved himself alarmingly wily. "Deploy decoys," she ordered. If there was one silver lining to the dark cloud, it was that her personnel knew their missiles intimately. Spoofing them would be easier than spoofing a missile of unknown design. "And stand by point defense."
"Missiles entering terminal attack phase now," Roach said. "Point defense going active now."
Kat watched helplessly as missile after missile raced into attack range. Thankfully, they'd had several days to test their point defense data net. They weren't caught by surprise, not like 7th Fleet. But there were just too many missiles for them all to be blown out of space. Hundreds died, others fell to the decoys and expended themselves harmlessly. But dozens made it through the point defense network and rammed home. Lightning rang like a bell, twice in quick succession. Kat grabbed hold of her chairs as the compensators fought to keep her ship and crew intact. She saw hundreds of red icons flash up on the ship's status display. Most of them vanished within seconds, but the remainder glared at her accusingly. Her ship had taken one hell of a battering, and yet she'd survived.
"Graceful and Princess Royal have been destroyed," the XO reported. "Cornwall and Jackie Fisher have been badly damaged."
Kat cursed under her breath. The missiles had specifically targeted the battlecruisers, the largest ships in the squadron. It was probably the only thing that had spared Lightning from destruction, and each of them had had over 1,000 officers and crew. She pushed the guilt aside, promising herself she would pray for them later. There was no time to waste. She keyed the console. "Damage report."
5 shield generators are gone,"
Lynn reported. The chief engineer sounded harassed.
"Major damage to..."
Kat cut him off. "Carry out repairs as quickly as possible," she ordered. It looked as though they'd been lucky. Lightning's shields had been weakened, but her drives and most of her weapons remained intact. They could still fight. "We don't have time to withdraw." She turned and looked at the tactical display. It looked as though they'd swept the planet's orbitals clear of anything threatening, but it was impossible to be sure. And yet she knew it didn't really matter. They had to move fast before the theocratic fleet returned and caught them in the act. "Check with the Marines," she ordered. "Have they located the enemy bases?"
"Aye, Captain," Roach said. "They've established a number of facilities in and around the planet's major cities."
She took a moment to study her squadron's status, then nodded to herself. "Cornwall and Jackie Fisher are to withdraw into hyperspace," she ordered. Cornwall didn't have a working vortex generator, but now that the missiles had stopped exploding, Jackie Fisher could take both ships into hyperspace.
"They are to head directly to Gamma Base."
"Aye, Captain,"
the XO said.
"The remainder of the fleet is to close in on the planet and start destroying the bases on the ground," Kat added. "Do we have a link with the PDC yet?"
"No, Captain," Ross reported. Kat grimaced. If the PDC was monitoring near-orbital space, they should know that the Theocracy's ships and orbital installations had taken a pounding. But what if they couldn't tell the difference between friend and enemy? What if they fired on her ships, on the assumption that Royal Navy wouldn't be able to mount a relief mission so soon? Still, there was no time to delay any longer. Engage the bases on the planet as soon as possible, Kat ordered. She glanced at the planetary display. It was dark near Gibraltar, just after midnight. Hopefully most of the civilians would be in bed away from the occupation forces, and then warn the troop transports to prepare to launch shuttles. She watched grimly as bases on the planet started to die. It looked so simple on the display, as if it was nothing more than a computer game. Yet she knew the reality behind each icon as it flared, then darkened. People were dying, and not all of them enemies. There was no escaping the fact that a number of civilians, and perhaps captured Commonwealth personnel, would be caught in the blasts and killed. But there was no alternative. She had no time to land Marines who would eliminate the hostiles while preserving the civilians. And besides, she knew the Theocracy couldn't be allowed to develop a habit of using human shields. It was easy to imagine them using human shields everywhere, if they thought it would deter the Commonwealth from attacking. And yet, she told herself, the simple survival of the PDC was reassuring. The Theocracy had refrained from using weapons that would take out its shields, knowing it would devastate the entire planet. But they thought they had all the time in the world, she thought. They didn't know we would take the offensive so rapidly.
Captain, Roach said, the Marines have identified a number of POW camps.
Mark them down for attention from the shuttles, Kat ordered. She looked up and noted their positions on the display. Thankfully, most of them were well away from the cities.
And tell the Marines they can proceed with deployment.
Captain, Ross said, the jamming is gone. Kat let out a sigh of relief. They must have taken out the generators when they'd bombarded the enemy bases on the ground. There was no longer any need to rely on the PDC.
Transmit the pre-recorded message, she ordered.
Davidson would be down there, somewhere. She refused to believe he could be dead.
And ready the second flight of shuttles for immediate departure.
Aye, Captain, Ross said. The XO grinned at her.
All bases on the planet, apart from POW camps, have been destroyed, he said. Their forces are in disarray.
Kat grinned back. Even if they had to beat an immediate retreat, they'd given the Theocracy a bloody nose, as hoped. Its occupation force had been smashed. The Theocracy would have to put together another force for Cadiz, one designed to hold down a civilian population that had learned just how nasty occupation by the Theocracy could be. And the Theocracy couldn't afford to look weak. Not now. The war had barely begun.
The insurgents will take most of them out, I hope, Kat ordered. Do we have any of our own forces reporting in?
Several, Ross said. They're requesting immediate pickup.
Detail shuttles to recover them, Kat ordered. And warn the pilots to watch for ground-based fire. We can't assume the bombardment took out all of their SAMs.
The XO opened a private channel.
The Marines know their job, Captain, he said. Trust them.
Kat flushed. She'd been micromanaging. Understood, she sent back. And thank you. She forced herself to sit calmly in her chair, thinking hard. Assuming there wasn't a prowling starship watching her squadron, and none had been detected, it would take 45 minutes for a signal to reach Cadiz 7 from Cadiz. They would have that long before the enemy commander realized the planet was under attack. And then, what? They'd war-gamed the battle as best they could, but they'd already been surprised at least once. Would the enemy commander turn and engage Kat's squadron? Or would he persist in trying to engage Admiral Christian? Given the Theocracy's advantage in firepower, Admiral Christian had planned a long-range duel rather than closing to energy range. But plans could go wrong.
Shuttles are on their way, Captain, the XO reported. The POW camp has been targeted for careful attention.
Kat winced. If the Theocracy had time, they might blow up the camp rather than allow the prisoners to be recovered. They knew better than to expect mercy from the planet's population, not now. She'd offered to uplift any of them who wanted to go, hoping to encourage a few defectors. But no one had replied so far. It was quite possible they wouldn't believe her message. The refugees had said that enemy soldiers were warned to expect nothing but suffering from the Commonwealth.
Good, she said.
and now all she could do was wait. Chapter 39. Davidson jerked awake when his implants started to beep.
"Wake up," he hissed as he sat upright. "They're here."
Jess rolled over and stared at him.
"So quickly?"
Davidson accessed the data download and blinked in surprise. "They're recovering personnel from the PDC and detention camps," he said.
"This isn't a full-scale invasion."
Jess sat upright. It crossed Davidson's mind to wonder briefly how she posed as a man in such close contact with men. But he decided he didn't want to know. She got to her feet and looked upwards, peering through the canopy of leaves high overhead. Once again, pieces of debris were falling through the atmosphere, leaving trails of fire in their wake.
"So,"
she said, "are you going to leave?" Davidson considered it briefly. Part of him wanted to stay and help prepare the locals to fight for their freedom. But he knew his duty. His orders were to call for pickup, then return to the Commonwealth to join the war. One Marine wouldn't make much difference, he tried to tell himself. But Cat would need him.
"We need to call a shuttle," he said. "Come with us."
Jess glared at him.
"Are you suggesting I just abandon my homeworld?"
"No," Davidson said.
"I'm suggesting you come with us now, help build up a force to recover your world, and then return when the Royal Navy retakes the system for good."
He took a breath.
"They're going to be mad when they return," he added.
Flashes of light in the distance suggested that nearby enemy bases were under attack.
"They'll sweep the countryside for anyone who might have helped the resistance. Come with us and you can survive."
"I am going to stay," Jess said.
She turned and addressed the Marines.
"Any of you who wish to stay too will be welcome. If not, we wish you the very best of luck."
Davidson winced. He understood all too well. If his homeworld had been occupied, he would have wanted to stay and fight too, even though he knew it would be futile.
He was damned if he was surrendering to the theocrats.
But he also knew that he had his duty.
"If any of you wish to stay," he said, "I'll put you on detached duty. But it may be years before Cadiz is liberated."
He looked at Jess, deliberately not looking at his men.
"Go underground, stay out of sight, and build up your forces," he said. "Keep our radios. We've already shown you how to use them. When we return to the system, we will contact you and coordinate our activities with your forces. But don't engage the enemy too openly."
"It depends on what they do," Jess said. "Call your shuttle, Patrick."
"Captain," Corporal Loomis said, "I'd like to stay."
Davidson sighed. Loomis had been talking to the farm girl. Perhaps he should have had a word with him before he became too attached. But there had seemed no point in interfering with something that might have helped if they had remained stuck on Cadiz. Marrying into local families was a common insurgent trick, creating ties that made it harder for their new relatives to betray them.
"Then make sure you do not fall into their hands," Davidson ordered.
He wanted to scream at his subordinate to point out that their duty lay elsewhere, but it would do no good. Instead, he nodded shortly at the younger man.
"And watch yourself on this planet."
Turning, he led the way towards the nearest suitable landing zone, using his implants to signal for pickup. Moments later, he had a reply. The shuttle was on the way.
"The enemy are holding the range open," Admiral Junaid observed.
He couldn't fault the Commonwealth warships for their tactics, but it was irritating as hell. Both sides were launching missiles, yet only a handful of hits, none of them fatal, had been scored.
"And our gunboats are equally matched."
"So it would seem," the cleric agreed.
Junaid kept his face blank. They'd managed to prevent the enemy super dreadnoughts from recovering their workers or destroying the facilities, but the enemy commander was clearly settling in for a long, stern chase. It was a losing game, Junaid knew. He had far fewer missiles to expend than his opponent. Judging by his opponent's decisions, it was clear his enemy was well aware of his weakness.
"I should break contact," he thought bitterly.
but it will make me seem a coward.
Admiral, the communications officer snapped. The planet is under attack. Junaid whirled. They attacked the planet, too? The destroyers got off a message, the communications officer said. It cut off before it could be completed.
Destroyed, Junaid thought.
Losing the destroyers was annoying, and losing the planet would make him enemies among the Inquisition. But it would be far from fatal. There was no shortage of ill-educated young men willing to serve as the hammers of the true faith, not when the rewards were so great and oversight almost non-existent. And yet, he took a breath. It might just work in his favor if he used the report as an excuse to break contact. They couldn't accuse him of fleeing in the face of the enemy if he was attempting to save the occupation force. "Prepare to reverse course and enter hyperspace," he ordered. "Take us back to the planet, best possible speed."
"Captain, POW Camp 1 has been liberated," the XO said. "We're loading the former POWs onto the shuttles now."
"Have the medics standing by," Cat ordered. They'd located every medic on Gamma Base and transferred almost all of them to the troop transports, but she was bracing herself for a humanitarian disaster. No one believed the theocracy would take good care of its prisoners, not when they had shown a frightening lack of concern for their own lives. "And the remainder of the shuttles?"
"They're picking up stragglers now," the XO reported, "but there are fewer than we might have hoped."
"They might think it's a trick," Cap thought grimly. There were interstellar agreements against broadcasting certain kinds of false signals, but the theocracy hadn't signed any of them, any more than it had signed navigational or POW conventions. It was quite possible that thousands of Commonwealth personnel would keep their heads down until Cadiz was liberated once and for all. There was nothing she could do about it.
"Have them returned to the ships as quickly as possible," Cat ordered. She wanted to ask if Davidson had been among the people recovered, but she didn't dare say it out loud, not even through a private channel. It would probably take weeks to sort out everyone who had been in an enemy camp. Many of them would probably be locals snatched up along with Commonwealth personnel.
"And the PDC?"
"General Eastside has expressed an interest in remaining with a volunteer skeleton crew," the XO reported. "The remainder are being loaded onto the shuttles now."
Cat wondered just what the general was thinking. The PDC was tough, but it would be stormed eventually, particularly if some of the ground troops were withdrawn. Did he think he could force the theocracy to tie up its troops, or was he just reluctant to return to Tyre with such a disgrace hanging over his career? Admiral Morrison hadn't been the only senior officer in the system, after all. There was nothing she could do about that either.
"Wish him luck," she said, as the shuttles started to rise off the planet's surface and begin the climb back to the troop transports. "And get me a headcount as soon as possible."
"Captain," Roach snapped, "I'm picking up a vortex, multiple vortexes." Cat swung round and stared at the display. 55 minutes. 55 minutes since the attack had begun. By her most optimistic calculation, it had taken the enemy commander little more than 5 minutes to swing his fleet round and return to Cadiz. She would have been impressed if 4 squadrons of super dreadnoughts weren't bearing down on her tiny squadron. There was no way her 7 remaining warships would be able to slow down a single super dreadnought, let alone 4 entire squadrons.
"Order the remaining shuttles to lift off now," Cat ordered.
At least they had a contingency plan for this, although not one she'd ever wanted to use. "If there are any POWs left on the ground, they'll have to take their chances."
"Aye, Captain," Ross said.
"Order the transports to start Operation Breakaway," Cat ordered. She ran through the situation in her head but saw nothing apart from certain disaster. The sheer weight of firepower bearing down on her made any tricks utterly immaterial. There was no way she could just stand and fight.
"And they are to prepare to open vortexes."
She shook her head, cursing the enemy's timing. If they'd come 10 minutes later, she would have been able to get most of her people out. As it was, she had to pull off another tactical withdrawal under fire. Only worse. They wouldn't let her open vortexes for the shuttles.
Or would they? She considered trying to open one close to the planet, but she knew what the enemy would do. A few antimatter explosions would force her ships to close the portal before more than a handful of shuttles could make it into hyperspace.